Hello, ladies and gents. As always, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Behind the Brain podcast. And today's guest is a lady called Sophie Medlin, otherwise known on Instagram as Sophie Dietitian. Now, this lady has gathered vast amounts of experience working in the dietitian slash nutrition industry, and she has seen it all and done it all and worked with everyone that you can imagine. Got in contact with Sophie a few years ago about referring certain clients out to her, and she's been absolutely brilliant. Okay, a really ethical person, like morals, just a good person who has a very client-centered based approach, which is sort of what we want in our industry. But what's quite cool about this episode, she doesn't just talk about herself, but she talks about loads of other cool sort of, well, they're not cool, I suppose, disorders that, some of the things that me and you may have not heard of. Anyway, without further ado, let's get to the show.
Hello, ladies and gents. Welcome to another episode of Behind the Brain podcast. And today I have the lovely dietitian Sophie Medlin. Is that how you say your second name?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've got it right. So, I've followed Sophie and had numerous chats with her for a couple of years, I imagine now. I've listened to her on podcasts, even watched her on telly, which we'll cover a little bit later. I've even read some of her articles. She's kind of a big deal. But I've never really delved into, I don't know if Sophie's ever done a podcast like this, about talking about Sophie and her background, sort of. But the first thing I suppose I would like to cover is, what made you become a dietitian?
Oh, great question. So I was a really strange 15-year-old kid that just knew this is what I wanted to do. There is more of a backstory to that, which I'll tell you now, seeing as we're here. When I was growing up, I really struggled at school. Like, I was just being naughty. And I was like, when I was 13, I was out and doing my thing, and I got a job at a pub so I could earn some money so I could go out drinking and stuff with my mates. I was just like living my best life. And I decided that I wasn't going to do very well. I was basically predicted like D's and E's in my GCSEs, and it was just not a good time. And I realized at some point that my dad would be super mad at me if I got D's and E's in my GCSEs. And I thought, well, better pull my finger out. So what I did was I basically taught myself the curriculum for everything at home, the stuff that I hadn't learned in the classroom. I taught myself at home, and then it was basically GCSE results day, and I was absolutely terrified. I'll never forget. I was absolutely terrified of what my results were going to be. I was crying in the school with my envelope in my hand. And my French teacher, who'd predicted me, I think, an F, came up to me and she was like, "Why are you crying?" And I was like, "Well, I'm just really scared about my results." And she went, "You got a B in French, open your envelope." And it turned out I did really well, but I didn't think I was smart. Like, I didn't think I could do anything. And we'll maybe come on to this a little bit more later, but it turns out that I didn't get diagnosed until a few years ago, actually, but I've got ADHD, dyspraxia and dyslexia.
Wow.
So it makes sense now that I couldn't learn anything in the classroom, but then I could teach myself at home. And at that point, I was like, well, actually, I'm really interested in nutrition. I'm really interested in food. I'm really interested in science. And I think this is what I want to do. So, yeah, I was really lucky to know from an early age, despite some kind of turbulence, that this is what I wanted to do. And I've been so lucky. I've loved every kind of chunk of my career.
And that, wow, that's different to how I suppose I saw life. I didn't have a clue what I was doing until I was like 27. And that's obviously led into personal training, thank God. But wow, that's so interesting, because when you're to know what you want to do at 15, there obviously must have been an underlying like passionate thing about that. But how did you know, like, what did you, because I've envisaged dietitians, there's like a lot of giving there, as in, you know, you want to help people, like a certain industries like mine, like yours. Is that one of the key things as well that you wanted to do? I wanted to help people within reason, is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think I would say when I decided I wanted to be a dietitian, I don't know that I really understood very much about what dietitians did. And I obviously played the like, don't want to be a nutritionist or dietitian game. And I realized that if I was a dietitian, I could kind of do everything. Whereas if I was a nutritionist, I couldn't work in the NHS and stuff like that. And I didn't really know quite where it was taking me, but I was really interested in the science of nutrition. And I've always been, like, I love food, and I've always liked cooking for my family and cooking at home and stuff like that, even when I was quite young, making cakes and all that kind of stuff. And I think that like food for me is a really nurturing thing. Like it's an important part of how I show that I care for people. And I think that that kind of also translates into my career choice in terms of, and I guess people probably think that dietitians take food away from people. Well, what our main job is to make sure people can eat as well as possible and enjoy their food, right? Even if they have to make changes to their diet. And that kind of all feeds into it as well, I think. So there's like a nurturing thing around food. There's definitely like a caring profession thing that I really appreciate about it. Like being able to help people is such a gift. And yeah, the science side of it just always really fascinated me.
What would be the biggest difference between a nutritionist and a dietitian? I know that, but just for the listeners.
Great question. So nutritionists are... basically, we all do a degree in nutrition. So registered nutritionists would have done a degree in nutrition, same as dietitians, but dietitians then learn how to apply that to medicine. So dietitians then do hospital placements and work in the NHS to learn how we can apply the science of nutrition to treat medical conditions. Mm. And basically, if you have any kind of medical problem, you need a dietitian, not a nutritionist. Nutritionists are for healthy people and dietitians are for sick people.
Okay, right. When you say a medical condition, what sort of things does that cover? Don't worry, we are going to get back onto you. I just hopefully so people know that obviously guys and girls, like dietitians, for me, when it comes to food, any sort of food issue is the people that you should speak to. I often find that some people say have certain issues with food or how they view themselves, and usually they go and find a personal trainer, whereas actually in my eyes they need to see a dietitian.
Yeah, so I specialize in colorectal conditions, so really specifically disorders and dysfunction of the large bowel and the rectum, so very specific stuff, which we'll perhaps talk about a bit more why I do that later. But I have a big, and also work on people with their relationship with food, so disordered eating, eating disorders type stuff. But I have a big team of dietitians within my business. And the reason for that is that there is like a specialist for every area. There's a dietitian specialist for every area of kind of medical conditions you can think of, really. Mm. Nutrition is a super broad field. And if I was pretending to my patients that I was up to date with diabetes research as well as gut research, I would be lying to them and to myself. Like I haven't seen a diabetic patient for years. So I have a diabetes dietitian on the team. We have a pediatric dietitian on the team. We have someone who looks after functional gut disorders, things like IBS on the team. And we have like a really broad spectrum of people who are highly specialist dietitians in their area of practice. That means that they've done, you know, years of postgraduate training, research and practical experience in that particular client group that I just haven't done. So we, you know, we do have that specificity around what kind of conditions we look after, basically.
Wow. So even in like when I look at you guys, I probably label you in one group. You actually have quite a strong referral network as well.
Yeah, I mean, they all work within my business, which is so great. And that's kind of always been my big goal with the business, is sort of having those proper specialists for people. Mm. You know, everyone's a real expert in their own condition these days, right? Mm. You can learn so much about your condition online. If you then turn up to my clinic, I've not heard of your medication before. That's not good for me. That's not good for you. That's not what anyone needs. And I think, you know, particularly in private practice, we have a real... what's the right word? We've got a real responsibility to provide a level of service that's actually good value for money and actually massively improves people's quality of life, because they're paying for it and it's not cheap, you know?
Yeah. So you went to uni. How was that?
I went to uni. Do you know what I did? So I grew up in Devon and I decided I wanted to go to Surrey University, and obviously got the grades to get in there. And I didn't think I would. So I got the grades to get into Surrey, which is sort of one of the top universities. But actually, when I got in there, wasn't very happy, couldn't really settle. It was very academic, which again, I still didn't know about my learning difficulties at that point. So it was not really taught in a way that I found particularly accessible, very kind of traditional education. I think it's different now. I mean, this was 2004, so that's a while ago. And I just couldn't really make friends. Like I was living in this really weird flat setup where it was like, honestly,
come on, tell us.
I will tell you. So there was a guy who had brought a Thai lady home from his gap year, and she moved in with us, and she'd left her husband and her child in Thailand. And she was like, as we were living there, the immigration police came and took her away. Like it was, I mean, that's just one of the people. No, another one was like just some really odd characters, like unusual people who would be unusual in any situation, right? But it was just particularly like disorientating because I just didn't, I couldn't connect with anyone. And one of the girls in my flat was, I don't know if I should tell you this because obviously she's a dietitian, she might listen, but we just like, she was in a funny place in her life, and yeah, I was trying to make friends with other people on the course, and then she'd be like, oh, I've been for coffee with so-and-so today, and sort of taking these people away from me, and not like, it was just all a bit of a funny setup. So I wasn't very happy, wasn't settling in. The course wasn't quite right for me. And I'd actually also got a place at Plymouth University, which is near where I grew up.
Mm.
And so, and that was a 3-year program rather than a 4-year program at Surrey and those sorts of things. So eventually I just rang my dad and I was like, oh, and then just as I was like at the last, like my end of my tether, there was like a sewage leak in my flat. And then I walked into the flat and it was like literally just poo sat on the carpet in my bedroom. And I was like, Dad, can I come home, please? I don't want to play anymore.
Oh, wow. What an experience.
I know. And it was a shame because, like, I think hopefully there's some young people listening who can kind of recognize that uni is not always what you hope it will be. My sister went to Reading University, so she was really close down the road. She was just a year ahead of me, and she had such a great experience. You know, she loved it and had such a good time. And I thought I'd have the same experience, and it just wasn't quite like that for me. So then I transferred down to Plymouth, finished my degree there, and that was great. And they taught in a very practical way and a very kind of inclusive way, and that was much better for me anyway.
Yeah, because I suppose, what part of Devon did you come from?
So I grew up just outside Plymouth in the South Ham, so a place called Yumpton, which is like a tiny little village that no one's ever heard of.
I didn't even know you were from Devon. I spent a bit of time in Plymouth. I loved it there because it's obviously quite a cool city.
Yeah, it's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, rough around the edges, but it's a good night out.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, and what age did you finish that?
So I finished at 21, and then I went straight into work in hospitals, which was retrospectively like quite a heavy thing to do. I don't think I'd really thought about it at the time, just kind of go to work, don't you, and do your thing. But yeah, I moved, and my first job was in Birmingham, which was amazing, like super fun city, and it was really sort of, this is 2007, so it's really kind of up and coming at the time and developing more in terms of it being a bit more cosmopolitan, I guess. Mm. It's a really fun place to be. I loved working in hospitals, so much fun. You're with loads of really like-minded people, and you know, everyone's working for a common purpose to try and get the patients better and things like that. So it's a really nice environment to work in, but emotionally pretty heavy for a 21-year-old, retrospectively. I see 21-year-olds now and I'm like,
no chance. No hunt. Do you get drafted to that, or do you choose where you go, or is it just like you haven't, did that when the course finishes, like, oh, Sophie, you're going here, or is it like,
yeah, no, so in your placement, so as part of your degree you have to do 9 months of placements essentially, roughly, and those you don't get to choose where you go. You're basically are told you're going to live in Bristol for 3 months, or you know, for me I went to live in Manchester for a month and all over the place. But when you work, when you finish, when you've graduated and you're qualified, you apply for whichever jobs you want to apply for. And it's reasonably competitive in that first kind of little bit because there's lots of graduating dietitians at the same time. But there's loads of jobs in the NHS, which is great. And it's kind of, the key really is to try and be flexible about where you want to go, which is why I ended up in Birmingham from Devon. And I was always like, this is what I'm just going to do. I'm just going to go where the job is. And working in a big teaching hospital in those early days, it was really helpful because you're learning from like top specialists rather than generalists and smaller teaching in small hospitals, you know.
What when you're in this hospital, I just imagine you in like a white, you know, like a professor suit just walking around. I don't know, what are you doing there? That's what I suppose I want to know.
So I worked in that first NHS job I had, I worked in elderly medicine. And so we were trying to, it's a lot of what we call nutrition support. So trying to help people who have poor appetite or are struggling to eat to get enough nutrition in. So in that role and in that department, I specialize, there's a really highly specialist Parkinson's disease clinic and a highly specialist motor neuron disease clinic. So these neurodegenerative conditions that very often have impacts on things like your swallow, so your ability to actually swallow anything at all. So then we do a lot of tube feeding, talking to people about whether they want a tube or do they want to just try and manage as long as they can without a tube, and all these kinds of difficult multidisciplinary team decisions that include like very patient-centered, as in what's your long-term plan, is this what you want, it's okay if it's not what you want, and yeah, working with lots of people with dementia and things like that. So it's a really good foundation in learning more, applying I should say, the understanding about how we can improve people's nutrition, and also really crucially the huge benefit that nutrition has when someone has been undernourished for a while. And you can just, we start tube feeding and suddenly you see them improve, and they're like, that how alert they are gets so much better, and that suddenly improves, and then they can do more with physio, and then before you know it they're out the door, you know. It's so positive.
But that's quite a humbling experience in your early 20s, isn't it, you know, to see people like see that other side of how some people live or what they have with them.
I think when you're in your early 20s and you just kind of get on with things and you just don't really reflect on actually like the magnitude of what you're doing, you're just kind of, oh, this is what I do now. Like when I look at it in retrospect, I feel differently about it, you know.
Well, yeah, when you look at it now and you think of those times and you go back to those memories, it's like, bloody hell, that is actually quite, you know, like a big thing, right?
Yeah, and I'm like, how did you do that? You're only a baby.
So you've gone into you've gone into the hospital now. What, I take it you didn't set up your own business straight away?
No, not at all. So I did, I can't remember how long it was now, but I basically did 8 years in the NHS all in all. So I worked in that job. I then worked in head and neck. So when patients have, so it's a cancer multidisciplinary team. So when people have a tumour in their mouth or in their throat, and they have to have operations on that, and they also have to have radiotherapy and things like that, they obviously can't eat anything because your mouth is blocked off by whatever's going on. So we have to, again, tube feed those patients. And that stuff was like incredibly rewarding, like working in a multidisciplinary team where people, again, everyone's working for the common like goal of improving the patient's life, making the patient survive, everything else. That teamwork was really special and really amazing. Like, I think people think it'd be depressing, but it was so rewarding, so, so rewarding. So I did that, and I also looked after intravenous feeding in that hospital. So when patients' digestive tract isn't working, has failed for whatever reason, we then can feed all of their nutrients into their veins directly. So what we have to do is figure out their nutritional requirements down to a very fine art, and then deliver that intravenously and make sure that's going to look after their bone health for the rest of their life, and that's not going to make them have problems with diabetes or liver failure and things like that. So that was like super sciencey stuff that I loved, and having sort of both parts of that job was great. And then I moved back down to Devon. I was working in Torbay Hospital, where I headed up the nutrition team there. So again, intravenous feeding, intestinal failure stuff. And a lot of that was colorectal work, so looking after people who had had bowel surgery. And things like, so I do a lot of work with the stoma community, so people who have a colostomy and things like that.
Yeah.
And that is amazingly rewarding work, because I mean, anything in terms of colorectal stuff is really rewarding, because if you imagine, lots of my patients worry about continence. So they worry about whether they're going to have an accident when they're out and about and not be able to get to the toilet on time. They might have very problems with noise and wind and things like that, that, you know, society makes people feel very ashamed about. And as a dietitian, I can really help them with that. And that is then completely life changing for them, and they don't have that problem anymore. And it's, their quality of life improves so significantly. And that is like the most rewarding work I do, for sure.
Because that must cause some people an utter stress and anxiety to do some of the things I imagine I take for granted, nip into the shop, go into work and stuff like that.
Yeah, big time. So then when I finished that job, what happened was I decided I wanted to be a lecturer, and one of my old lecturers came into the department that I was working in opportunistically for a visit. And I said, I think maybe, the thing is, I'd had a couple of difficult meetings with my manager where they were basically like, yeah, there's no room for you to progress in this department. So you either need to leave and go to a different hospital or like just stay at the level you're at. And I was 26, something like that. I'm not going to stay at that forever. So I was like, well, maybe I'll get into lecturing. Lecturer came into the department. I said, I'm really interested in getting into it. What do I need to do? What do I need to do? My PhD? Do I need to do a master's? And she went, actually, I've got loads of clinical experience, and you know at the university that I trained at Plymouth. And she was like, well, why don't you, they've got a maternity leave post coming up, why don't you apply for it? So I applied for it and I got the job. And so I did part-time academia, part-time NHS for a while, then full-time academia, and then from Plymouth University I went and lectured at King's College for 3 years, which was really tough but important work. And then I set up the business. So like there's loads of different steps before I sort of decided that I thought I knew enough to be doing the stuff I do now, really.
Did you ever give any time for yourself?
No, still
learning that.
For sure.
So talk to us a little bit about City Dietitians and obviously what you guys offer.
Yeah, so I was mentioning before, we've got a team of really highly specialist dietitians, which is, again, really important to me that people get really good value for money and actual specialist support for whatever medical condition that they've got. So as I said before, I do colorectal stuff, but I also do a lot of disordered eating, eating disorder stuff, which has become kind of a newer thing that I do, but mainly because I have ability to help people in that way. And it's more sort of around intuitive eating type work and trying to help people to understand how to look after their body because they like their body rather than because they hate their body and that sort of thing. So it's something that I feel like I'm doing a good job of and that my patients really appreciate. And so it's a really nice area to work in. I also do things in the commercial sector. So I design vitamins and probiotics and do consultancy for lots of different companies who want to get into like the nutrition space. So that all keeps me busy too. And then I do some media work, as you say, writing and things like that, a little bit of TV work and all sorts of other bits and pieces in that space.
We're not just going to touch on the TV work. We are going to delve into that, right?
Okay.
So how was that experience for you anyway? Because I've obviously seen you on TV on a couple of things now. How was that for you?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the first time I went on TV because that was horrendous. So it was like peak veganism, peak militant veganism. So we're talking like 2017, 18 maybe.
Yeah.
And I was asked to go on BBC Two, so the Victoria Derbyshire show, to talk about veganism. So it's like a panel discussion thing. With a guy who at the time was calling himself the Prince of Vegans. And he basically, it was like, no, they don't really do it anymore because they've realized how bad it is, but it's like scientist versus evangelistic person who doesn't have any qualifications.
Yeah.
And basically what I said was things like, it's much more difficult to meet your nutritional requirements on a vegan diet. So we don't necessarily recommend it to people, but we'd always support people if that's what they wanted to do. Like nothing that was bad. But the trolling I got from the vegan community was horrific. Yeah. I got death threats, handwritten death threats to work. People saying they're going to come and rape my children. I don't have children.
Like,
these people who, you know, I was like, where is this coming from? Like, how is this possibly an okay thing okay way to behave? And so that was difficult, but at that time I'd just gone through a really difficult relationship breakup, so it sort of felt like my whole life was on fire anyway. So it was like, fine, whatever. And I think if that happened now, I think I'd take it a lot worse. But then I was like, well, like, you know,
there's other stresses in your life clearly that are going on. It's just like, this is actually minor, some idiot behind a computer screen who doesn't even know fucking thing about me.
And it was really lucky because I was working at King's, so my colleagues were very supportive and they were like, listen, this, what you said is fine, there's nothing wrong with it. The PR department at King's were great and they were like, it'll blow over, you don't need to say anything else, like what you said is fine and factual. So that was really, really helpful. But yeah, that was all a bit dramatic. My mum was like saying things like, oh, the vegans are so nice to animals but they're being so horrible to you. Like, it upset my mum more than it upset me.
Yeah, well, it's like I've got a couple of clients that are vegan and I you know, when I first started working with them, I say, like, I obviously support this diet, by the way, it's great that you're doing it, it's just a really hard diet to sort of get all that we need in your varied diet, so we have to supplement it, and here's some other things that we need to do. And I imagine that's something along the lines that you said, it's just a hard diet, isn't it, to get everything on. Yeah, that's it. So that's,
like, I learned a lot, sorry to cut you off, but I learned a lot from that in terms of like the way that you phrase things and caveating things on TV and all that kind of stuff. So it was a good learning curve despite it being unpleasant.
Wow, I didn't even know that. God, I'm learning so much about you. So that, obviously, that your first time was your worst, and thank God it didn't sort of taint that, and you ended up going back on again.
Yeah, and luckily, so basically what happens with that kind of stuff is that the BBC and Channel 4 and other places have like a archive of all the old footage that they've ever shot, ever, basically. And so when a producer then is looking for a dietitian, they'll search for a dietitian in there, and then stuff that I've done before comes up and they can see the other work that I've done. So whichever producer saw that and thought, yeah, she did a good job of that, despite the backlash. And I ended up with lots of other opportunities off the back of that. So I've done things like How to Lose Weight Well and Inside the Factory and these kind of magazine-y nutrition programs that people see a lot of.
Yeah, because you've done quite a few articles, I see, as well, haven't you? Which is good.
Yeah, that's been good. I mean, that's some of them are kind of opportunities to write a whole article, which is sort of what I prefer to focus on these days. But there's lots of quotes and stuff in press, which is really helpful for the business. And, you know, it's almost, obviously, I've worked really hard. I've been in the game for a long time, which helps massively. And the credibility of working somewhere like King's is, you know, you can't really match that anywhere else, to be honest. So having that all behind me is super helpful to being a credible voice in nutrition. And it's kind of, you know, I feel very fortunate. It's all a bit of a perfect storm, really, because people are so interested in nutrition and so, you know, interested in what we do and all that kind of stuff. And I think we're sort of, well, we were talking about it just before we were recording, weren't we? But there was this time where everyone was looking to influencers and other people for nutrition advice. And now we're turning this corner where people are more interested in getting credible advice from credible people. And because of the length of time I've been in my profession and the specializations that I have, people are looking to me for that information. And, you know, I feel really lucky to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I feel, I suppose, like we said earlier, I think before the call, our own echo chambers, but I feel like people I know and personal trainers in my industry, like we're much better at spotting who we should and shouldn't work with straight from the off. Like it's, I feel like I know I have quite a thorough procedure of whether this person's going to be right for fit for me, am I going to be right fit for them, and I can know quite early on just by certain questions whether actually I might refer that person. I think that's getting better. I hope it is. Like I said, our echo chambers, you know, that it might not be, but I, you know, if you're getting busier, then that's the that's better, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good. I think that people are getting better, but certainly the, you know, we are of a generation where it's easier. People are a bit more sensible. People made all the mistakes of their very early 20s and their late teens, and they're sort of thinking, actually, I need to do this properly this time. And that, I mean, we still see people trapped in, I mean, I still see a lot of patients who've seen terrible personal trainers who have put them on horrendous diets for many, many years and really mess their relationship with food. And I'm talking about mostly people who pay a huge amount of money to see those personal trainers, you know, people who are seeing like the elite personal trainers. Those people are the people getting some of the worst advice I've ever come across.
Yeah.
And really, you know, really affecting their relationship with food. But I think there is this sweet spot in the middle where people are just going, actually, I've got enough clients and I'm rather you saw someone that's actually going to help you than you see me. And that's, you know, how it works within my business and outside my business as well. And I think that's comes from a place of confidence in your own knowledge and your own, you know, financial situation, all that kind of stuff. You know, when you're just starting out, you sort of feel you need to take all the clients that come your way because you need the money, whereas when you get to a point where you're actually like, actually that's not the right thing to do, things get better, you get better at your job, and then everything gets better. I think,
yeah, I think as well, if you like you said, I definitely said yes to everyone when I first started, but what I learned from that, it's not about actually needing the money, it's actually I know that it's not morally right, and I know that I'm doing them a disservice if I take them on, and actually I'm giving myself a massive hard job here, because like, why is this person not sticking to the plan? And it's so much more deeper, whereas you can obviously dive into that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? And it's the same with us, like if we can't help people, well, my job is only really lovely and fun and nice when I'm helping people and they're getting better. When we're stuck and they're not making progress and it's hard and they're not getting better, that's not very fun for me. It's obviously not fun for them. And that's where you sort of get into the space where it's like, well, I don't want to keep taking your money because I'm not helping you. Where can I send? And that's when I'll send people to psychologists or to other healthcare professionals. Obviously, we do a lot of work with GPs and consultants in terms of tests and things that needed. But that, you know, there's plenty of people that I pass on to people, particularly for psychological support, because it's outside of my scope, you know.
So what made you decide to dive into the things that you specialise in that you said you was going to cover?
So when I was in the last hospital I worked in, I was working with amazing specialist nurses who then put me forward for opportunities with colorectal patients and also things like writing for charities and that sort of thing and speaking at conferences and those sorts of things, which was great. And I wrote a few journal articles and stuff like that, which was really positive for my career. And I would never have had the confidence to do that if I hadn't had those people around me saying, you know, this is what you do and you're great at this, and you know, you've got a I don't know whether the right word is talent, but you've got something like, not everyone can do this, but you can do this and you're good at it. And that's amazing to have like senior people, and it's women as well, senior women nurses, not dietitians. Dietitians generally at that time like to tear each other down, not build each other up.
That surprises me, you know.
awful. I had those people around me, and actually I just loved it. Like I was saying before, like I think the difference you can make someone's quality of life is incredible, and that really just motivates me in that area in particular. And I feel very lucky that I got into it. And at that time, no one was talking about poo commercially. Do you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't a market for that. There was no strategy there at all that one day I was going to start an Instagram page talking about people's poo. That was never a thing.
Yeah.
It was just like, this is something that I really love and I really can help people with. And then when I started working at the first university I worked at, a lot of my friends were physios, and they did private practice stuff on the side of their lecturing jobs. And they were like, well, why don't you just set up a clinic in this physio practice and just see what happens? And so I did. And then I got lots of patients, and that was great. And sort of started seeing people on the side. And I loved that because it also kept my hand in with patients, you know, just lecturing is fine for some people, but it just didn't feel like I was a real dietitian anymore if I wasn't seeing patients.
Yeah. You're not fully in the industry, are you?
Exactly.
I suppose, yeah.
Exactly. And then, of course, when you're doing that kind of work, in any kind of private practice, you start picking up people who want to lose weight. And when people want to lose weight, there's no point, as we all, everyone knows what they need to eat in order to lose weight. They just don't do it. We're all the same. And it's all, we're all tied up in the emotions around it. So that's when I sort of really started delving into emotional eating, trying to understand the thought processes around that and what goes on for people. Did some additional training in cognitive behavioral training, therapy, and things like that, which was really helpful. Communication skills training and those sorts of things, and consultation skills, upskilled a little bit, and actually sort of got really into the understanding about disordered eating, eating disorders, and what goes on. So that has never been a kind of big clinical focus for me, but it's something that I pick up because I have a good understanding of it, and I can really help people, and it's generally word of mouth that people come to me for that kind of work. And obviously now I do a lot of that stuff on Instagram too, which is important because people need to hear something that isn't the same bullshit that everyone else is saying on Instagram, you know. So that's kind of, and also around when I first started private practice stuff, I started doing Facebook stuff, just trying to dispel some of the myths that I was seeing, because that was like the beginnings of Instagram, and I was like, the stuff I was seeing just was unbelievable. So I started doing some myth busting stuff then. So that's been going on for a long time.
So that's always been, I didn't know that then, because I've obviously seen you've been doing your videos recently, the Gwen one, which killed me. That's good stuff. So you've been doing that for years. What sort of myths? Like, just give us two.
I mean, if you remember back in the day, so we had Deliciously Ella talking. So she was one of the first and biggest Instagram influencers right at the beginning. She was talking about how she's cured her POTS by this clean eating vegan diet thing. POTS is a condition that is actually, the advice you would give for someone is the opposite of that. Basically what happened is she grew out of her POTS, but she was telling people that she'd cured it through her diet, which is nonsense. So there was that stuff going on.
Did she have a product?
What, I mean, Deliciously Ella? I mean, she's got a million products now, isn't she?
Shock, horror.
Products, everything. And then, of course, you had Joe Wicks coming through talking about coconut oil, putting coconut oil in absolutely everything, which is full of saturated fat. And as public health institutions have worked for years to try and get people to cut down on the saturated fat. And as people did cut down on the saturated fat at population level, heart attack levels went down. Then along comes someone like Joe Wicks, no nutrition education, saying everyone should eat coconut oil. And, you know, the consequences of that could be really far reaching in terms of heart attack risk and stuff like that. And it's just those influencer type people who have no nutrition education taking up that space and spreading dangerous messages was sort of the thing that really motivated me to try and make a difference in that space, really.
That's good, because like those, obviously, like, speaking of Joe, I imagine Joe Wicks has turned a corner in the last couple of years, because obviously he got bashed. I think it was something like he said a statement like calories don't matter, and that just everyone hammered him. And like 2 years later, because I quite like him, like he gets people moving and stuff like that. But like you say, he's one of those guys that influencer profile is mega relatable, everybody loves. But what some of the nutrition advice he's talking about is shockingly shit.
Yeah, it's just wrong, like actively wrong. Yeah. And I think now he is a huge brand, obviously, and so he employs dietitians and nutritionists in order to get those messages a bit better, and that's obviously really important. Charlotte looks after his wean and 15 stuff, and she's amazing, and that keeps the new children safe. But Deliciously Ella was telling parents to wean kids on on vegan diets and things like that, which is really risky for children without any caveats around making sure they're getting enough B12 or anything like that. So, you know, that stuff is dangerous, but the bigger, and some, like Ella, unfortunately resists the nutrition, like mainstream nutrition education stuff. She's not interested in that. She sticks with her guns and just blinkers. Whereas Joe, I think, has been much more open to kind of getting it right. I think his heart is absolutely in the right place.
Yeah. Yeah. God, that's quite surprising. So I didn't know. Did not know you've been myth busting since bloody like 04.
Literally.
So what's now, like, what's your next endeavor? Because obviously you're definitely, even though you probably hate me saying this, you're a high achiever, you know, you're always constantly, you know, setting the bar for yourself. What have you got next in line for yourself?
Well, next year, like, there's lots of potentially really exciting things in the pipeline for next year. So I feel very positive about that and sort of trying to keep this sort of, I don't know, open mindset about it and see what sticks, and just know that there's lots of exciting irons in the fire, and we'll see. They've got opportunity to go and do some work in Dubai, sorting out kind of colorectal services over there, which would obviously mean I'd spend some time over there, but not every week over there, if that makes sense. Some sort of fly in, fly out type situation. Some exciting TV project stuff that might come off. If that comes off, then I won't be doing anything else apart from that for a few months. So that'll be good and exciting. And then I'm hoping to write a book next year.
Yes.
Supporting people, that's kind of on my agenda. I've been meaning to write one for years, but I think I've sort of formulated it properly in my mind now, so that's exciting.
What will that cover? Will that just be about poo, or that'll be host of things?
We're going to start with the disordered eating stuff and trying to help people in that. I think that's where the biggest need is. And then obviously once I've got a publishing deal, then I can do the poo stuff in the background, because there's a smaller market for things like dietary advice for particular client groups in terms of bowel stuff. And I'd love to be able to do that and fill that need, because it's so needed, but it's niche. And until you've got a bit of a name and you're selling books, people are going to be less interested in it. So yeah.
With the disordered eating, what sort of falls under that? Because I can guarantee you can probably name a few, like, you know, someone might not think it's disordered, but actually it potentially is.
Yeah, 100%. So the key, but my key client group that come under that sort of disordered eating category would generally be people who are a bit overweight, or are a weight, so they're a healthy weight, but they want to be slimmer, and they've perhaps yo-yo dieted for a long time, crash dieted for a long time, and they realize that all of their approaches haven't worked. They've usually got a very negative self-talk sort of set up in their head, and they will usually be either on a diet or off a diet, good or bad, you know, that kind of mindset. So getting them into a more straight down the line kind of looking after your body every day, rather than sometimes yes and sometimes not, but not in a really strict and rigid and rule-based way, is the way that we work with them. So basically anyone who feels anxious about their body or about food or about, you know, their diet and things like that, those are the sorts of people that fall under that category. And I sort of differentiate that from anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa, in that, like, you're not necessarily underweight, you're not dangerously underweight, you don't need to go into hospital, all of that kind of stuff. So physiologically you're safe, but inside your head things are not good and not positive around food in your body.
Right, God, yeah. So that's
For your audience in particular, there's an eating disorder called MODY, which is muscularity oriented disordered eating. And this we used to only see it in men, but it's more coming through in women now as well. And a lot of women who've recovered, in inverted commas, from an eating disorder, anorexia, now develop MODY. So they just swap control, obsessing about their body in one way. So preoccupation with thinness with preoccupation with muscle mass, or with following the very strict rules of building muscle mass. And a lot of the things that we see, behaviors that we see promoted by like men's health and these big influencer type platforms, things like making sure you're having huge amounts of protein every day, making sure that you're doing your meal prep every day, not eating off your meal plan, making sure that like you're very rigid about your training, getting anxious if you can't do your training properly, all of these kinds of things, those all come under that muscularity oriented disordered eating. There's a good screening tool for that if people are worried about themselves or anyone else. You can Google MODE, M-O-D-E screening tool, and you can have a look at that and see whether you think you fulfill any of those criteria. And basically it's just there's questions on there like, do you feel anxious if you haven't got enough protein powder in the house? And I suspect there's quite a lot of people who fall under that category.
Wow.
So Yeah, it's something that we're learning more about and trying to support men, because, you know, it's rare, it's not as rare anymore, unfortunately, but it's rare in men to have a preoccupation with thinness, but it's common for men to have a preoccupation with muscularity.
God, you see the right... God, just blown my head off there. Just like all those little things. I'm just thinking, God, have I got this? No. But no, it's quite interesting, isn't it? How like we have these little things where we've gone through certain experiences in our life and that sort of created that. Do you find that comes from the bodybuilding community? Do you find like men's health and, or is it they do women's health as well? Do you find those things helpful? Or
I think they are trying to change the narrative.
Okay.
But I think that the way men's bodies and women's bodies are portrayed, you know, I've talked a lot on my social media about women being infertile, if basically being infertile if they've got a six pack. So most women will have two, if they've got a six pack, most women, and not all, we all exist on this sort of body fat percentage curve and things like that. But most women, if they've got a very visible six pack, will not be producing estrogen in enough quantities and won't be having a period. Yeah. But that's the sort of body shape that we're shown in women's health is what we should all be aiming for. And in men's health, though, the body fat percentage of the men there in those spaces is ridiculously low. And I don't know, and maybe you know more, but I don't know many men who, even sort of bodybuilders, who are walking around with that level of body fat percentage most of the time. It's largely for photo shoots and that sort of thing, and they mostly would have taken a load of diuretics and whatever else to try and get down to that shape. You know, you will know that steroids and other kind of growth hormone things are being used more and more in among young men to try and achieve a body shape that's shown to us to be like what we should all be aiming for, when actually it's the exception, not the norm.
Yeah.
I think there's a sort of thought process amongst younger men now that every guy is walking around with a six pack under a shirt, and like, well, that's not true. I think that partly, sorry, I'm on a roll now, partly it comes from things like I notice on Netflix programs or whatever else, where guys don't go to the gym, they're not in the gym, but if they take the shirt off, they're absolutely ripped. And like the narrative is never this guy's training every hour of the day. Same with the women on these programs, the narrative isn't she's starving herself and training every hour of the day, but their physique suggests they are, but that's not part of the story. So I think guys think that that's what they should look like, and it's, you know, how it should be as a normal person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Like, as in people, it's about perspective, isn't it? I essentially know when I see people say posting up pictures of them, they've just competed or done a photo shoot, because we have that education, we know actually you feel like shit and you feel like you just want to faint. Whereas to the common Joe public, they're like, oh my God, that guy breeds health. And it's like, that dude could not walk up a set of stairs because he's going to pass out. Like, and unfortunately that's becoming, I suppose, more common. Cause I go to a gym that's like, you have all sorts of people there. It's a lovely leisure center, a really good gym. But I see like 18-year-old kids in there, and I just know that they're jabbing up, taking gear. And I'm thinking, God, is that because they come in here and they see the older guys who take the stuff, or is it because there's an influence on social media? It's just, it's quite, I suppose, like we were saying before the call, it's actually quite a sad place for younger people, because they're seeing this stuff, aren't they? And they think that's normal. It's normal to have the Kim Kardashian curve bum. It's not. You know, I think it's good that dare I say it, like a bigger lady's more accepted in a way, but sure, you know, but we all know that most of that's bloody plastic.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is a mess, isn't it? And I think I have seen, which is great recently, more guys showing, I can't remember who it was, but I saw someone sort of guessing whether someone's been taking steroids or not. And like a personal trainer was looking at their bodies and going, these are the signs. And yes, I would say this person has taken steroids. Yes, I would say this person has taken steroids. And I think more of that is really helpful, because I think younger guys can go, oh wow, I was looking at that person as someone who I really want to aim towards, when actually they are doing things that are really dangerous for their health.
Do you think that comes from where we live in an era, you know, and I definitely fall under this, like a lack of delayed gratification as well, though, because obviously steroids are just an instant, you know, to a degree, went up within a month, you know.
Do you think that's an issue as well? I think as well that just the pressure that young people feel to look a particular way, and you know, with weight loss, there isn't that quick fix in the same way, although people will tell you and lie to you and sell you skinny teas and stuff. There just isn't an easy way to achieve that weight loss, but there is an easy way to get really bulky really quickly. It's not good for you. And just like to clarify that the side effects of steroids are horrendous and can last the rest of your life. And it's not the, the number of people who I've seen on stroke units, men who've been taking loads of steroids and end up having a stroke because of how juiced up they are. Like that's a, I mean, I would say probably every stroke unit on the, in the country has a guy who's a bodybuilder guy on the unit right now. Like it's a reasonably common thing.
Wow. That's the issue as well, isn't it? It's like you've got like the clever juicers and you've got the guys that just, you know, don't understand sort of the levels that they should be taking it. Yeah.
God. But I mean, also just years of putting your body under that much pressure, you know, it's like, it's not, we're not designed for it. It's not safe. And that's only going to become more common, unfortunately. Yeah, messy. But you know, as we were saying as well before, I think 2019, Facebook has known that they're causing body image problems. Facebook has known that for a long time. They've done, who obviously own Instagram, and they've done nothing about it. So there is going to be potentially liable cases there for people saying, well, you knew that you were harming my body image, and now I'm in this situation post-pandemic. Or parents saying, well, you knew that this was causing harm to my daughter and now she's killed herself or she's died from anorexia. Like this is their, that's their responsibility, in my opinion.
No wonder that, I know it's always a bit dodgy referencing a Netflix documentary. Do you remember that? Do you know the one where they talk, the guys that used to work, what that's called?
Social Dilemma.
No wonder all the ex-employees of like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter wouldn't let their children, and I mean teenagers as well, have any of these platforms, right? They know you got these robots behind these screens that are just, you know, doing all this stuff to grab our attention consistently, aren't they?
Yeah, danger face.
Right, Soph. How do people find you? Reference your clinic as well, please.
So the website for the clinic is citydietitians.co.uk. You can book in online with any of the specialists there. So feel free to jump on there and have a look around. There's also great resources on there in terms of blog posts and things like that, about all sorts of things from the whole of the team. My socials are at Sophie Dietitian. So you can find me on Instagram and Twitter. The clinic has a Facebook page, which is at City Dietitians. And yeah, I'm active on socials. So jump on and say hi. Very happy to talk about things. People have got questions or they're not sure. Jump on, drop me a DM, and I'm very happy to chat to people.
Right, Sophie, thank you for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.